Some slightly different theme music for Open Air this week. Kirill Gerstein's recent recording that is soon to be released of Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. Good afternoon, I'm David Latulev. It's Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. Quite a lineup for you today. Today we'll be having conversations with Kirill Gerstein, who's performing with the San Francisco Symphony this week. Composer Mark Ahlberger talks about this weekend's San Francisco Composers Chamber Orchestra concert. Conductor Don Harms tells us about next week's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony concert. Dan Hoyle will share some details about Each and Everything, his new show at the Marsh. We also learn about the Crowded Fire Theater West Coast premiere of Brahman E, a one hijra stand-up comedy show. Plus, critic Joshua Cosman offers his classical picks for the month of June. Stay with us, and we'll get started right away. And starting things off is the show that's at the Crowded Fire Theater, the West Coast premiere of Brahman E, a one hijra stand-up comedy show. It's by Aditi Brennan Kapil, and we've got a couple of the people involved in the show today. Imran Sheik is an actor. He's been seen on both coasts in a variety of venues, including San Jose Rep, Fringe NYC, and the New York Shakespeare Exchange. On TV, he's done commercial work and is a series regular on Guy Code on both MTV and Comedy Central. Imran is also a co-founder of Parwaz Playhouse, which has been featured on NPR and the BBC, and a resident actor at American Renaissance Theater Company, an articulate theater company. This show is at the Crowded Fire Theater here in San Francisco, and we're also being joined by the director of that show, an award-winning director, Aaron Merritt, who is best known locally as founder of the all-female Shakespeare company Woman's Will. Since leaving that company in 2009, she's worked with Bay Area Playwrights Festival, among other projects. I certainly would like to welcome Aaron and Imran to our studios. Let me just switch things around here. There we go. I think we have you now.
Hello.
Hello.
Free-ring circus going on in this studio. Absolutely amazing. Well, I need to find out how this show got started.
Sure. I think Aaron.
Right. I actually could talk about that. So I am also the producer of the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, which is an annual event that is a development process for new play. So playwrights bring in plays that are usually close to finished and ready to be just polished to send off to regional theaters and to be produced for their premiere productions. And we just give the playwrights a little extra time, a little extra resources to be able to move those plays along in the process. 2 years ago, Aditi Kapil brought in Brahmani, and I did not personally work on it. I was there present and just fell in love with the play at that time. And so after the festival, I asked her to please keep in touch with me personally and let me know when the play was done and let me see it. I really wanted to know how it turned out. And she did send it on to me. And then later I saw Crowded Fire announce they were doing it. And I called them and said, oh, love this play. Please have a crack at it.
Well, you've got some experience in this gender-bending kind of experience.
I do. I do. Yeah. Now, it's the other way around. I worked with women helping them perform as men, perform male characters.
Mm-hmm. Imran Sheik, you are the star of this show. How did you first come across this play?
So I actually heard about it. It was premiered at Mixed Blood Theater. And so I heard about it that way. And I heard about Aditi, and I knew that she does really good work. And then I saw that Crowded Fire, it was in Crowded Fire season. And so I contacted them. And, I said, hey, I would like to audition for this piece. And it just went from there. And then I auditioned online, virtually.
That's right. I hired him over Skype.
I think I mangled the pronunciation. It's hijra?
Hijra.
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 And where does that name come from?
So that name is a term given to people who are intersex. It's kind of a...
Yeah, it's a complicated term. So it's from one particular part of India, mm-hmm. and it's a term that is generally used the way we would for a couple of different things. So either an intersex person or a transgender person, someone who's in some way living between the genders.
It's like an umbrella term almost.
Right. And there, I mean, there are very particular, traditionally the hijras are eunuchs. That's not really the case anymore. So it's a term that's in flux, but it was the closest Indian term she could use. And it is about an Indian American person.
I understand in Chicago, the title role was portrayed by a female.
That's right.
So did you have to change some of your approach to it, Imran? Or is it, is it for either sex in the way it's written?
I think it is. I think it's for either sex because I don't think I'm giving anything away here, but in the beginning, the character has a male persona. And in the second half of the piece, she has a female persona. And so I think it doesn't change anything in particular with the play itself. For me as an actor, you know, I went in not thinking about that necessarily, like, oh, this is written for a woman. I need to do this a certain way. It was, this is written for a person who can be both. So that's the approach I took.
Yeah, it wasn't really written for a woman. It wasn't written for a man. It's the character is... It's not even actually really a real intersex person. This did not represent the real life of a real intersex person. It is part of a trilogy that she's written that's investigating what the three main Indian Hindu gods would be like if they lived as modern American humans. So the god Brahma, she imagined as possibly intersex. And what would that be like if that character lived on Earth?
Right.
So she's played the role herself. The first production, she split the role with a guy. So they did different nights of performance. I would say that the show itself does change depending on the personality and the mannerisms that person brings to it. But it's interesting. It's equally interesting either way. If it's a male,
gender influence though.
Like what gender you perceive that person being first. What gender. What place along the gender spectrum that person is comfortable walking. Because really this is, like Imran said, this really is just a person when it comes down to it.
Right.
And so where does the comedy come from?
Everywhere.
All right, let's go there. That's the thing about the piece. It's so brilliantly written and it's so funny and smart and witty. And it's just... That's where the comedy comes from. And it comes from the fact that it is a stand-up show. It's presented as a stand-up piece.
It really is a universal story. Even though it talks about gender a lot, it converses with gender and how we perceive gender in a really, really smart way. Right. It's at the same time talking about imperialism, colonialism. It's talking about all sorts of things. And the universality of it is in the awkwardness of trying to discover and own who you are, starting in puberty when you're hormonally stupid. and we've all lived through that. And so that's where the humor really comes.
And it tackles those things with a really positive kind of upbeat way.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's no victimization going on. And I think that's the sign of good satire, where it's a positive kind of upbeat, smart way of looking at it. Instead of saying, oh, woe is us, oh, woe is me. It's kind of like, no, let's look at it from a position of power. You know, let's empower ourselves and kind of make fun of it that way. It's kind of like The Daily Show and John Oliver's show and Colbert Report.
Almost. Neat. Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun for the audience as well.
Yeah. We hope so. Yeah. It is for us.
That's Imran Sheik, actor, and Aaron Merritt, who is directing Brahman-E, a one-hijra stand-up comedy show at the Crowded Fire Theater. It's the West Coast premiere getting underway. It got underway on Monday, or this coming Monday, and runs through June 8th. Information at Crowded Fire.
Sorry, it's June 28th.
June 28th. Information at crowdedfire.org. Aaron, Imran, thanks for coming in today and telling us a little bit about it. Well, pianist Kirill Gerstein is only the sixth recipient of the prestigious Gilmore Artist Award and an Avery Fisher Career Grant in 2010. He's won several international competitions. No stranger to San Francisco, he made a San Francisco Symphony debut in July of 2005. Most recently appeared here in 2011. He's performing this week with guest conductor Charles Dutoit in the San Francisco Symphony and Beethoven's Second Piano Concerto on a program that also includes Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. I spoke to him yesterday, just prior to his rehearsal. Kirill, nice of you to take some time this morning to talk with us, and welcome to Open Air.
Oh, it's good to speak to you.
I understand some of your early piano skills were self-taught by listening to your parents' collection of jazz records.
Yes, so I started studying classical music, as is somewhat common for children in Russia, and that was so very proper and organized studying. From the outset, my mother is a professional musician and teacher, and then I went to one of these special music schools for gifted children, the kind of system that they have in Russia. But the other interest that I quickly developed was for jazz, and that was the component of my background that was indeed self-taught from recordings, because there really wasn't much information or access to information about jazz and sort of a living culture of jazz that I could have had access to in Russia.
What were some of those early recordings that you recall?
It's interesting. A lot of this has sort of faded in my memory, but one that I recall very well was the famous duo disc of Oscar Peterson and Dizzy Gillespie. I remember that. And actually, a few years ago, I bought that disc prompted by somebody that asked me a similar question. I thought, oh, this one I remember, so I wanted to re-listen to that.
And then at the age of 14, you came to the U.S. as the youngest student ever to attend Boston's Berklee College of Music, and again for jazz piano.
Yes, so until that time, I was in this so professionally geared music school studying classical piano, playing jazz more on the side and trying to do as much as I could on my own. And then came this opportunity to study at Berklee. And then the following 3 years, or 2.5, 3 years, I spent studying more jazz, and classical was a part of my musical life, and I went to Tanglewood in the summers, and so I had contact and engagement with that also. But those couple years were spent more intensively engaged in jazz until I was about 16, 17, when I felt that I had to make a choice, and that's when I chose as the main occupation of what I do, indeed, concentrating on the classical repertoire.
Was there something in particular that triggered you to go towards classical, or is it more a career choice?
Well, I felt and feel that to do either of these styles, to give it your best shot, is to be engaged with it for more than 100% of the time. And so to do more than 100% dedication to two such vast areas of music didn't seem possible. And I still believe that. So there are people that are great jazz players that play some classical, and there's some great classical musicians that also play some jazz. But to do both with equal dedication and seriousness is, I don't think, is possible. And therefore comes this sort of choice that one is faced with, which one is so in the passenger seat and which one is really the main driving force. And for me, I felt, even though I got to know and experience firsthand these joys of at the spur of the moment fantasy that jazz allows, faced with that choice versus roaming in the creations in the minds of people like Rachmaninoff and Beethoven and Bach, who, by the way, were all great improvisers, we know, but something that they sat at home with and worked out over sometimes 6 months. Sometimes you see composers working and struggling with a piece for a year, 2 years. That in its nature allows for such deep layering of contextual, so interconnections and really layers of complexity And so deciphering, interpreting that, studying that, peering into that was ultimately what I thought, and I'm not disappointed with my choice, what would be the most engaging for me. But I'm glad that that this other part is also in my background, and I do feel that one influences the other. And especially in the last couple of years, I've also started to branch out a bit again and do some jazz related,
like Chick Corea and others.
Yes, and with Brad Meldow, or some cabaret songs with Storm Large from Pink Martini. And so I think all these things enrich how I play Beethoven or Rachmaninoff. And certainly when I try to play something that's not written down, the experience of playing all these pieces also kind of bleeds through.
This program also includes Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, written as a portrait of sorts of the Stalin years, written after his death. It must be hard for you to imagine the kind of Russia that Dmitri Shostakovich lived through under such control and oppression. Do you hear stories from your parents about those years?
Yes, it's so hard and at the same time natural. Somehow the culture where I came from, and I still so got some glimpse of the Soviet Union growing up, and then of course from my parents and the whole circle and grandparents, one feels that as part of so a collective narrative that's familiar to me. So I do. I find it easy to identify with his music. For the Sunday, we're playing the Shostakovich Quintet with members of the symphony, and so I can understand this, so the bleakness and the tragedy and the conflict and the overtly projected optimism, which is actually the cover of incredibly dark mood and surrounding. So I don't find it so foreign or far from me. But of course, I did not experience it and would never claim to experience it as people that were growing up in the 40s, 50s, 60s in the Soviet Union. And that was certainly a very, very different kind of thing. But as I said, it's a part of the collective narrative that I think one gets when one grows up in a place. And so I'm glad that I got that.
But you became a U.S. citizen in 2003. Is there something that triggered that need to become an American?
Well, I think what's more important for me is that I came to the U.S. when I was 14. And so I feel that it was a good time that I did not lose the Russian language and the connection to the culture. And at the same time, I came early enough that I don't feel completely foreign here. But anyway, this kind of moving about and then moving as a concert musician, first to study and then to perform, you lose a certain sense of the roots. On the other hand, I feel that I gain a certain perspective and comfort in many places. So I don't think I'm Russian as somebody that lives in Russia, and I'm not as American as somebody that grew up here and went to kindergarten, and I'm not German, even though I spent a significant part of my time also in Europe and in Germany. But something in all these places becomes close, and something that I can relate to, and so that's so my attitude to these different homes and places where I've grown and experienced change. This.
Well, I mentioned the Shostakovich 10th Symphony that's on the program, but we haven't even talked about the Beethoven Second Piano Concerto, written in 1790 or so, which scholars have shown was actually written before the first piano concerto, the numbering system being based on the publication time rather than the actual composition time. Now, the work of a Beethoven in his early 20s, not as performed as the other concertos. What draws you to the Second Piano Concerto?
Oh, I think we're very lucky as pianists to have five concertos and the triple concerto, the choral fantasy. And Beethoven became a great composer rather quickly. It's actually stunning if you look at so his juvenile pieces, so in his 12, 13, 14, 15. So it's so very okay and so gets proficient, but not great. And then you have the Opus 1 trios and the Opus 2 piano sonatas, and it's just this really explosion, breakthrough of how quickly it went from okay to great, and then greater and greater and greater. And so in that sense, the first, the second concerto, as you said, being the first written, is also not at all so immature piece. And I think it's a piece where he very quickly, like in other early works, announces and shows us that he owns the tradition. He has understood and absorbed the models of Haydn and Mozart. And at the same time, this is not just a Mozart concerto written by Beethoven, but very quickly, near instantly, he makes the form his own. It's now with his own quirks, with his own character, and also of his own scale. And it's a big piece. It's duration-wise, it's not short. And so these enlarged proportions as opposed to Haydn, Mozart, and a great sense of humor in this piece. So Beethoven is typically so portrayed a la the Fifth Symphony with shaking the fist at the heavens and protesting fate and fighting it. And that's a part of him and very much part of his middle period. But there are a lot of pieces where he's in terrifically good mood. And the second concerto is one of those. So there's a lot of humor and wit in the first and third movement. And the second movement, I think, owes to a lot also to his studies with Salieri. We know that he studied with Haydn, and we know that he studied with Salieri, who was a great Italian opera composer living in Vienna. And you hear that Beethoven also absorbed this from him. So there's this kind of declamatory, near operatic style in the second movement that is incredibly beautiful.
And you've worked quite a bit with Maestro Charles Dutoit. I'm wondering if you could briefly tell us that special relationship.
Yes, actually, with Maestro Dutoit, I think it's now exactly about 10 years that since we've started playing together. And so he was one of my early important experiences in my professional life, and I'm very fortunate that I've had the chance to work with him often, regularly through the years, and in a lot of different repertoire, and I enjoy this musical and by now personal friendship, and he is needlessly to say, a wonderful conductor, very elegant conductor. I think somebody that in part carries this the great French tradition of conducting. We have a lot of conductors that descend from the German lineage, and Charles has that, of course, as well, but also the great French historical school. And he's a man of great culture and very broad musical tastes and broad cultural knowledge. And so it's always an enriching experience to play with him and to be with him.
Well, we can hear him warming up already the orchestra for the Shostakovich, and you're next on the rehearsal schedule, so I'll let you get some warming up going yourself, and I wish you a wonderful performance, and we hope to see you next time you're in San Francisco.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Pianist Kirill Gerstein performing with the San Francisco Symphony and Charles Dutoit. Tomorrow at 8, Saturday at 8, and tonight at the Green Center in Sonoma. In the background, we're hearing a little bit more of Kirill's recent release, Imaginary Pictures, music of Mussorgsky, pictures at an exhibition, and Robert Schumann's Carnival. It's a new release on the Mirios Classics label. David LaTulipe with you for Open Air, our weekly conversation with movers and shakers on the Bay Area cultural scene. Still to come, a talk with Dan Hoyle about his one-man show at the Marsh. More music on the way via Don Harms and the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. Joshua Cosman will also stop by to talk about the classical picks for the month of June. And we continue our musical conversation now with a couple of gentlemen involved in the San Francisco Composers Chamber Orchestra. Old First Concerts presents Across Time and Space. Dr. Mark Ahlberger is the music director, conductor, and founder of the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra. Composers Chamber Orchestra. Mark is an eclectic, prolific American composer of post-minimal, post-popular, and, quote, post-comedic sensibilities. Now, Mark, we're going to have to talk about that a little bit later.
Do we have time?
And he's joined today by Davida Verotta. When Davida is not composing, he's a professor in the Department of Bioengineering at UCSF School of Pharmacy. He was born in Milan and moved to San Francisco in his late 20s. He's been involved with the Composer's Orchestra, as well as Irregular Resolutions, the Festival of Contemporary Music, and others. And he also teaches. His piece, Rehem, will be premiered at the Saturday concert. Davida and Mark, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with what's happening during this particular program this weekend. We've got a number of composers represented.
Well, you may ask. Yes, we've got six.
Mark Ahlberger.
Right, and Davide is one of our six with Rehem. Towards the end of the program, the grand finale will be John Beeman with Ishi Emerges, including a 12-voice chorus, and me on second oboe. And we start with a chamber work from one of our associate directors, Marty Stoddard, Short Variations for Flute and Strings. We will also have kind of a game-like piece by Michael Cook called Triangles with lots of threes and lots of madness. As well will be Brian Holmes, who has his own mad energy with two vocal works, somewhat on the post-comedic side, although downright comedic, I would say, in his case. What else do we have, Davide? Have I covered six?
I spaced out a second, but I'm sure we have, well, My Piece is Easy, then we have...
How can we forget fellow Italiano, Roberto Beccari, coming all the way from the old country to do Bridges, which is kind of a meditation on the space between, particularly the Golden Gate and the Ponte Vecchio, which will feature Maria Mikayenko as soprano soloist. So it's an amazing show across time and space.
Indeed, and it's a great space. Speaking of space, it's a great space, Old First Church.
Oh, fantastic.
It's just
the
nice
acoustics.
Because you've got a little bit of a raised dais where people can see what's going on with this wonderful new music.
Great acoustic, very resonant.
We have been delighted to be there for the past, six, seven, 8 years. They've been very good to us, and hopefully us to them.
That's Mark Ahlberger, music director, conductor, and founder of San Francisco Composers Chamber Orchestra.
Somebody had to do it.
Yeah, indeed. Davida, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the piece that's going to be premiered for you.
Yes, Rehem is basically an orchestral version. It's a bit complicated, but it's an orchestral version of a sextet that was a part of a one-hour-long work that we just premiered last month at Trinity Chamber. And it was a very large work, and I really like the last section that was for sextet. And it was a very exuberant piece, roughly of Shostakovian kind of inspiration, maybe Prokofiev a little bit.
Incredible
and
high
so,
energy.
Yeah, it's very... It alternates, as I often do, between lyrical moment and very highly energetic section, you know, and... I think the Italian in me take over a little bit too much occasionally. and so I decided to write an orchestral version, you know, and this is what we are going to play.
Very nice, very nice. Yeah.
And it just never stops. It just boogs along. Very, very exciting.
Yeah.
Is this typical of your composing style, or is this a new way of thinking about music for you?
I think it's a little bit of a new way. You know, there's a long piece that I mentioned, Il Ponte, that will be premiered in San Francisco in a couple of weeks, actually. It was kind of a turning point. And I realized that I was had a tendency of writing always too complicated and maybe too convoluted pieces and a bit obscure, maybe. So this is kind of a turn towards the clarity of the great composers. All of them are, in my mind, characterized by this bottom-line simplicity and clarity of intent and musical musical ideas. So this is pretty much in that vein. You know, it's a risk of running into, you know, new music people that kind of say, oh, this is too simple, but I decided to just go for kind of direct.
It is a very direct expression. It's very exciting and yet very beautiful. It's very, very clear to hear the intent as it goes along, and I think it's my new favorite Davide piece.
Oh, there you go. All right. We'll have to catch it. Now, Mark, let's talk a little bit about the Composer's Chamber Orchestra. Do you decide what gets to be played as director, or can anyone submit? Is there a vetting process for works to be performed?
Well, here's the deal. We started in 2002, and the vision was 16 performers. Everyone gets featured on one show, either the fall or the spring, maximum of 8 pieces. And some people just decide to just, you know, hang out and not present a piece for a while. But basically, people who are accepted into membership, both for their quality of composition and the quality of their performance on needed instruments, are basically guaranteed that they'll be featured during the course of the year. And, you know, that's kind of a crazy thing in some ways, that in a sense we're style blind. We're not quality blind, but we really do run the gamut from the very convoluted, shall we say, post.
Or weird.
we have, you know, jazz influenced, improvisational. We've had minimalist and rock influenced. You know, high art, low art, and in between art. Last concert we had the classic guy with the guitar up there. And we've also every once in a while featured great works in the past. We did our own Terry Riley homage at one point. We featured music of Bernard Herrmann from a science fiction episode of The Twilight Zone at one
point. I played in that concert. I was one of the bass flute players. Yeah,
oh, my Lord, that was our connection. That was so cool.
Amazing. 4 bass flutes, 4 harps.
And let's not forget that viola d'amore, shall we?
The very one that was used in that Twilight episode.
Wow. And Davide's good wife playing percussion. Oh, no, that was an incredible
thing. There's our connection. All right.
With John Kendall Bailey conducting and organizing.
That was the episode called Little Girl Lost.
Indeed. And where she was and what did we find it? No, fantastic. Yeah, and so we're a cooperative group. Amazingly, when I founded it in 2002, it was sort of like a musical Field of Dreams. In this case, if you put out the call, if you schedule it, it will happen. Mm-hmm. And a few years after that, in the middle of an almost musical military coup d'etat, we formed a board of directors and actually jumped into this fine venue of Old First, mm-hmm. Where we had been kind of mucking about here and there.
How many concerts are done in a year then?
We tend to do 2. Uh-huh. We've done as many as 4. But 2 seems to be our sweet spot because so many of us are involved in so many other things. Like, for instance, the Opus project that I run, a monthly concert series, da-da-da-da, commercial message there. Many of our people are academics, otherwise performing or performing musicians in other capacities. And then some people like the Philip Glasses of the world who, before making it big time, you know, had a career somewhere else, and you know, save those creative juices for our shows and other shows.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And if I can add, it's a great idea. I mean, it was originally a great idea of having, mostly the idea of having composer performers, you know, to basically join together and make up a group, mostly because it really opens up a completely different kind of interaction, you know, in terms of a learning experience. If you're part of the group, you know, you're communicating with composers that already know their instrument very well.
Right.
And that is an extremely fertile and growing environment to be in.
Yeah, there's a certain practical aspect there that perhaps sometimes doesn't happen with submitting a piece to another group, and they take a one-shot deal of it, and, you know, what happens. But we are able to work with the pieces and get to know them and love them, and get to know and at least tolerate each other, if not love.
And I'm assuming that one of your pieces will make it on the program.
Well, in the old days when we were just kind of getting rolling, a lot of people weren't actually, particularly when we did 3 and 4 pieces a year, concerts a year, a lot of people actually weren't putting it out that much. And I'm definitely, Davide's a quality man. And I am like my mom with Christmas gifts, quantity. And so I just put them out. And
20
so,
operas, 12 preludes?
Oh,
yeah,
few, just ridiculous. Sure, I just started my Lord knows what opera a couple of days ago on Christopher Columbus, but it will be the Spanish Colón. What's his first name in Spanish? I'm embarrassed. And exploring all sorts of manifestations of the hero and the scoundrel. But yeah, I just pump it out. But the old joke was that Ahlberger was on every show. Ah. But now we have so much other talent, and maybe I should say now that we really have talent, I don't need to be on every show. So I'm on every other, like any other good public citizen of the ensemble.
Very good. That's Mark Ahlberger. He's music director and founder of the San Francisco Composers Chamber Orchestra. Their concert is Saturday, June 7th at 8 p.m., Old First Presbyterian Church on Sacramento at Van Ness. Information at oldfirstconcerts.org.
Yes.
Davide Verotta, tell me about this piece, Rehem. We're going to hear that as we say goodbye. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can set up what we're going to hear on this piece.
You're going to probably hear the beginning of the piece, and again, you're going to hear the sextet, you know. So you're probably going to hear just a first couple of themes, you know. And the piece is kind of very complicated. It's organized like a double sonata, but it is intertwined with each other. So I decided to go to this almost never-ending sequence of motives that comes up one after another, and little by little they start to make sense because they kind of a kaleidoscopic thing that it keeps popping up, you know. You hear it, and then you don't hear it for a while, and then it comes back, and then another one comes back, and it takes a while to make sense of it.
But and we're hearing music of David Verotta here. Davide, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
As well to you, Mark, as he snaps a little photo of his experience. We'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
All right, thank you.
That's music of Davide Verotta. You can hear on this Saturday, at 8 o'clock at Old First Presbyterian Church as part of Across Time and Space, the San Francisco Composers Chamber Orchestra, presented by Old First Concerts. Information at their website, oldfirstconcerts.org. Well, in addition to being an award-winning actor, playwright, and writer based in New York City, my next guest is a Fulbright scholar whose time spent in the Niger Delta of Nigeria studying oil politics resulted in his one-man show called Things Day Happen. His most recent show, The Real Americans, recently closed its run at the Redgrave Theater in New York, and for its run here in San Francisco was dubbed Best Solo Show by SF Weekly, a top 10 play by The Chronicle, and was nominated for a Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award. His essays have been featured in The Chronicle, as well as Sports Illustrated, Salon, and Mother Jones. He also performs with his father, actor and comedian Jeff Hoyle. His current show, Each and Everything, A Search for Connection in the Digital Age, is receiving its world premiere at the Marsh, directed by frequent collaborator and fairly recent guest here on Open Air, Charlie Varon. It's a pleasure to welcome the younger Hoyle to our studios. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Sure. Well, let's start out with a nutshell synopsis provided in part by the subtitle. What is Each and Everything about?
Each and Everything is my journey to find connection in our sort of distracted digital age. So it actually starts with me hanging out with a two-time felon in small-town Nebraska and him asking me, why do you do this? And so I go back to Chicago in 2003 when I just graduated college and was hanging out with my best friend Pratim, who's the star of the show, and I'm in that period where I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do, and he's saying, you know, maybe you should stop listing freestyle rapping and Microsoft Word proficient as job skills on your resume. I mean, this is Chicago 2003, not Costa Rica 1999. And I'm sort of saying, well, I looked at joining the army. They pay off my loans, could get some interesting stories there. He says, man, killing brown people isn't that interesting. Lots of people do that, but there's only one Tim O'Brien's. Don't let your dreams die, man. And so we sort of go back to Chicago, and what I really want to do is get stories with people outside my comfort zone. And there's these corner boy drug dealers on my block, and they're my age, and I see them all the time, and I want to know what their stories are. So I buck up the courage and go out and try to talk to them, fail a couple times. Eventually, I get their attention, and he says, what's up, Mo? I'm Coco, but some people know me as Don Dada. Hold up, I think I seen you before. I think I seen you on the slave ships. See, they call me African American, but I do believe I got a little cream in my cafe. So I'm thinking, maybe one late night your great-great-granddaddy got all sweet up on my great-great-grandmama, and maybe I ain't forgot. But seeing as you a gentleman, must have been he was too. So maybe we just really long lost cousins.
And I'm very sort of nice, Dan.
Have a breakthrough there. Yeah, yeah. And so I sort of talk about going back to 2003 and figuring out this thing that I do, which is I go and connect with people, get their stories, put them on stage as a way of connecting these sort of out of our comfort zone experiences with larger audiences. Mm. And then the conflict arises when all of a sudden we have these little pocket TVs and our, you know, we have these smartphones, and all of a sudden I'm walking around and, you know, there's people walking down the street, reading about the street. They're walking down on their phone, you know, like, oh, it says it's a fun, interesting neighborhood with lots of cool characters. Cool. We totally did this neighborhood, without looking up from their phone, of course. And I meet a guy in New York who's talking about, he's like, yeah, man, it's not cool, man. It's not cool, man. Which is the Facebook and the texting, man. I mean, I remember watching the Jetsons when I was a kid thinking, oh, wow, the year 2000 is going to be flying cars. Yeah. Oh, what was the name of that Hispanic guy in the Jetsons? Yeah. No. There was no Hispanic guy in the Jetsons. Yeah, man, I used to worry as a little kid, if cars start flying, man, all the Hispanic people are going to disappear. You know, and so I'm sort of meeting all these people who are having this sort of, whoa, what's going on? This new technology is sort of pulling us away from that face-to-face interactions. So I go to a digital detox retreat in Northern California and meet these people who are kind of going through the same thing, you know, and saying, like, actually, it's not hard for me to sign off digital. Actually, I signed off on digital today. I signed off on 4 business deals today from my phone. That's how I signed off digital. I just hear, like, metal grinding and electronic noise in my head because I'm always on. I'm always working. Because I grew up poor on a farm, so I'm worried if I stop working, I'll be poor again. So I just work. I mean, I don't really live anywhere. Well, my stuff's, like, in a storage container in San Francisco. My stuff is, like, 20 white V-neck T-shirts, a snowboard, and a skateboard, so I'm homeless. But the other day, I was, like, standing in line to get coffee, and, like, all 12 people were staring at their phones. And so I start texting my girlfriend to tell her, and then I realize, no, I'm staring at my phone. And I'm like, what if everyone is talking about everyone else, but no one's saying anything to anyone? And so I have this sort of amazing experience where people are sort of trying to figure out, how do we move forward? And the detox retreat, the digital detox, is great, but it's kind of not quite enough. So my friend Pratim, he's like, man, why don't you go to India? It's like the internet in real life. with dying dogs and smelly armpits and people washing themselves in the street. And there's like 1.2 billions of people, so you could have random chats every day and never run out of people.
That's Dan Hoyle. He's a one-man show, each and everything, a search for connection in the digital age, portraying a variety of characters, most of whom you've probably seen at your neighborhood barista at some point or another. So, Dan, this show is at the Marsh on Valencia Street, directed by Charlie Varon. What does he add to the mix? You've worked with him before.
Yeah, Charlie is an invaluable collaborator. You know, he's a great performer in his own right. And he brings, you know, 25 years of experience of understanding how to tease out the deeper stories and the deeper narratives. So it's a privilege to be working with him. We've worked together for 10 years now.
Fantastic. And the show runs through July 12th, currently in preview since the last weekend. And full opening is on June 14th. Information at themarsh.org. Actor, playwright Dan Hoyle, thanks so much for coming in and have a great run at The Marsh.
Thank you so much, David.
We're going to continue our parade of guests in this last 14 minutes of open air. Joshua Cosman standing by to let us know what's going on in the classical world. Also joined now by Dawn Harms, who's just concluding her first year as music director of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony. Hello, Dawn.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, this concert has quite a bit going on for it. I mean, I'm involved in the flute section,
yes.
Full disclosure here.
And luckily.
We're pretty busy.
Yes.
So tell us what's on the program.
Well, we're doing a lot of music. We're doing 12 pieces, but don't let it scare you because they're all about, some are 5 minutes long, some are 3 minutes long, but it gives you a gamut of all the emotions from Gabriel's oboe. It's basically opera meets the movies, which is gives you, again, a big gamut. We have everything from Rusalka, from the opera Rusalka with Nicole Folland singing, and we have Burr Phillips singing the duet from Merry Widow, and we have a Chanticleer member. Dorita Seth is singing the sublime In Tortina from Carmina Burana. So it's just exquisite. And then we're doing some Copland. We're doing West Side Story Overture, Polovitzian Dances. But it's really fantastic, again, because it goes from one emotion to the next. And I just want to have just a blast of the concert.
That's right. Well, what have you learned in this first year as music director of Bars?
A lot of work. It's a lot of work, but it's fun work. I mean, it's very personal. I like to do a lot of hands-on, and it's not just sitting up there conducting. You know, sometimes you have to set up chairs and picking the music and the soloists and the halls, and it's a whole gamut, and it's basically a full-time job, but I love it because you really get to meet the people and work with the orchestra.
And we're still a young orchestra, too, so you're helping shape its sound.
Trying
entirely.
To, yes.
I should also mention, Dawn, that you're extremely busy on other fronts as well as a violist with the opera, is that correct?
No, a violin. First
violin with
it. There's a lot of viola jokes. Too many viola jokes, so I switched violin.
Over to violin. Yeah. And are you still involved with the rest of this season? You just played Showboat.
Too. Yes, just at Showboat. We're about to open Traviata and Butterfly, and I teach at Stanford and a New Century Chamber Orchestra.
We're going to have to say goodbye and get you busy.
Absolutely.
Work on those scores a little bit longer.
Yes.
We'll hear a little bit of something that's going to be performed on that concert, a little bit of Borodin for you, right? Thanks for coming in, Dawn. And
sure.
I'm sure we will have a wonderful Bay Area Rainbow Symphony concert. Information at their website, bars-sf.org.
And it's on June 14th. Yeah.
Music of Borodin to be performed by the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony at their concert Saturday, June 14th at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music under the direction of its music director, Dawn Harms. Yours truly, David LaTulipe, also participating somewhat in the flute section. Hope you can make that concert information at bars-sf.org. Well, it is the first Thursday of the month, and we're still having room to squeeze in Joshua Cosman to offer his classical picks for the month ahead. Welcome back, Joshua.
Thanks. Thanks for squeezing me in.
Go!
I do appreciate it.
I
paid Dawn $1.25 to slip that mention in of Showboat to segue into the thing, because I was going to say, I'll settle with you later, because I did want to start with a plug for Showboat at the Opera, which opened on Sunday.
Tremendous production.
It's a wonderful production, and it's a piece that is going to ruffle some feathers of people who don't think that there's any reason to be doing a piece like that in the Opera House. And I think the production itself makes as good a case for it as any. As David Gockley, the Opera's general manager, says, look, if we've got Fledermaus and we've got Merry Widow, this is those pieces. This is the American version of those pieces, and boy, it holds up. Mm-hmm. Falls apart after intermission, but
the plot, yeah, it's kind of the plot is kind
yeah,
of
yeah, it just kind of
no reason to goes, not catch Showboat.
No, absolutely no. It's worth seeing, and the casting is first rate. Morris Robinson is an amazing. Gives an amazing performance as Joe singing Old Man River, and there's other.
I just
other
had Todd Simpson on last week.
Oh yeah, and
terrific.
Long overdue company debut, right? the hunkiest of the Barra hunks.
Yeah. Information about Showboat at sfopera.com. Lots more coming up in June.
Yeah, well, the San Francisco Symphony is going to be in full force all month, and they're finally getting around to the Britain Centennial, because Britain was born in 1913, so most people did the Centennial last year, but the San Francisco Symphony is making up for it now, with 3 weeks of Britain in Davies Hall this month. Starting next week, there's going to be a music from Prince of the Pagodas, which is that wonderful ballet that Britten wrote after his visit to Bali, where he heard gamelan music and it sort of blew his mind. And he took some of the pieces, some of the sounds that he had heard in Indonesia back to his studio, turned out Prince of the Pagodas, and then even more tellingly, the music for Death in Venice, his final opera, shot through with a lot of gamelan sonorities.
Lots of Great Britain coming up then.
I see what you did there. That's this coming next week, June 12th to the 15th. Following week, my favorite Britain piece, the one that first got me excited about it when I first heard it as a teenager, which is the Serenade for Tenor, Horn, and String. Toby Spence is going to sing the solo part, the vocal part, and Robert Ward, who's the symphony's great principal horn player, will play the horn part. That was a series of settings of English poetry, wonderful range and variety, and a piece of great beauty and depth. That's going to be on the program June 19th to 21st with music by Copland and Shostakovich. Shostakovich's 15th symphony. And then the month closes out in big form with a semi-stage production of Britten's opera Peter Grimes, not actually his first opera, but his first big one and the one that made his name and reputation as a composer. Michael Tilson-Thomas is going to conduct that, and we've got Stuart Skelton in the title role, who's been here a couple times before, always with great success, and Elsa Vandenhever, who came through the conservatory and then through the opera training program, is going to sing Ellen Orford, Alan Opie as Balstrode, that wonderful piece about reputations and people in the small town on the British coast. So that'll be June 26th, 27th, and 29th. They're taking a day off in between there because singers are frail creatures and need their rest. But the orchestra is going to play a program on the 28th, which will just have the C interludes, which are the orchestral pieces from that piece.
That's a wonderful piece.
Yep.
Information about the Britain Festival at the Symphony's website, sfsymphony.org.
That is right. And also happening in June, Ojai North Festival. The Ojai Festival in Southern California comes to Berkeley every year now. They've got this sort of mutual swap system going. And this year we've got pianist and writer and thinker extraordinaire and MacArthur Genius Grant winner Jeremy Denk as music director. He's got a very interesting lineup assembled, primarily a new opera that he wrote. For which he wrote the libretto, and the composer Stephen Stuckey wrote the score, based on Charles Rosen's great work of musicology, The Classical Style. Haven't yet heard it. It's going to be premiered at the Ojai Festival and then come up here. But evidently, it's got...
It's a work of music based on that book?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My.
It's got characters like tonic and dominant. They have an argument about tonal relations and so forth and so on. I'm dying to hear how it's going to work out. And, probably some pastiche going on, but not too much.
Having slept through many of a chapter of Charles Rosen in undergrad school, it's going to be interesting to see how it comes out musically.
This was the way to have done it. The Brooklyn Rider, which is this wonderful New York-based string quartet, is going to be on hand playing Haydn. The Uri Kane Ensemble, the great jazz musician, pianist, and thinker, who is going to do some of his jazz arrangements of Mahler, which are unlike anything you've ever heard. And if you haven't heard those, they are worth hearing. Timo Andrus, the composer and pianist, is going to do his own take on Mozart's Coronation Concerto. It's a rewrite of it. I don't know what that means. There's going to be pieces by Kurt Weill and Morton Feldman and Stockhausen and Ligeti and a whole kinds of a smorgasbord of delights. So that's June 19th through 21st at Berkeley, courtesy of Cal Performances, and the information is at calperformances.org.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Finally, with the last remaining moments here, I want to give a blind plug for a new opera that's going to be done that same weekend. It's one of those, traffic wreck weekends. A piece called Anya 17 by a British composer named Adam Gorb and librettist Ben Kay, two artists about whom I know absolutely nothing. But this is coming to us from Opera Parallel.
Which we do know quite a bit about.
Which we know quite a bit about and have learned to trust implicitly over the years because they are really a wonderful and reliable artistic resource in the Bay Area. So this is a piece about sex trafficking, Anya. The title is Anya 17, and I think there's an implicit comma. She's 17 years old, is my understanding. That's what we're going to hear this month. That's June 20th through the 22nd at the Marines Memorial Theater in San Francisco.
Wow, that's quite a lineup for June. You must be a busy guy.
I'm always busy running around from here to there. But
information about Anya 17 at the Opera Parallel website, operaparallel.org. I'll spell that out. Opera, PARALLELE.org. I'm sure if you do a search for Nicole Beaumont or Anya 17, you'll get some information on that. Well, thanks for coming in, Josh. Anything else for you?
No, that's June in the proverbial nutshell.
I guess it is. Well, we're going to go out with a little bit of music of Britain from Prince of the
Pagodas. This is Prince of the Pagodas, the opening music.
Right, and I thank you for coming in. And
we'll meet again in July.
Keep your pencil sharp.
I sure will. Thanks, David.
Some music from Prince of the Pagodas as part of the Britain Festival of San Francisco Symphony. Those performances June 12th through 15th. Again, information at sfsymphony.org. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. All of our programs are archived at our website, kalw.org. You can send me an email if you'd like. I'd appreciate it, in fact, david@kalw.org. If you've got a program suggestion or you'd like to hear from a particular cultural ensemble during Open Air, I'm happy to entertain all and any comers. Much thanks to Niels Swinkels for herding the rounds of cats that came in for today's show. Thanks, Niels. You're a godsend. Coming up next, it's an hour of news from the BBC. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time on this, your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco. Also online at kalw.org. And then it's 2 hours of news from NPR and All Things Considered from 3 to 5. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco.